my expertise is in corporate governance and especially the legal aspects of it, but in my research I try to combine law and economics. And in my presentation I'll start a bit with a more positive analysis of this is what the law is, this is the reasoning of why people think this is a good idea, this is a criticism. But you will see that there's a bit my own vision in that as well, the more normative, what I think is good corporate governance or what is not the way to go. But my thinking on that is also in flux, and I'm really open to criticism and ideas there. So let's get started with some definition. What is corporate governance? It's a very straightforward definition that's used by the G20. Is a set of relationships between a company's management, its board, its shareholders, and other stakeholders. So that is what governance is. It's a very broad area. Some other keywords that I will use a lot during this presentation: sustainability. I've used the definition as staying within the planetary boundaries. Often it's also linked with social factors and governance factors. And then we talk about ESG factors. So the impact on a company's of a company on the environment, so climate change, but also pollution, water, of course. Social aspects, to what extent is there, the employees are treated well, is there a good work-life balance, etc. And the governance factors, is there good management of the risks of the anti-corruption, etc. And those are a bit the keywords I'm going to be talking about and framing into the debate of shareholder capitalism and versus stakeholder capitalism. That is a bit about, that's the question, the debate about stakeholder capitalism versus shareholder capitalism basically aims to answer the question, what should corporate law be about? What is the goal? And there's presumably the answer is, well, we need to maximize wealth for society as a whole. I think that's pretty uncontroversial. You could say like, okay, I'm not an utilitarianist, I don't want to maximize wealth. It's also about fairness and stuff like that. In corporate law, there's much less of that discussion because people think it usually it's just something very economical, something that you can measure in utility and trade-offs. So that's the goal, maximize welfare. But the question is, of course, how? What's the best way to do it? And there you have a bit two broad views, shareholder governance, stakeholder governance, or shareholder capitalism, stakeholder capitalism, that those are the terms that you used. What are the ideas for these views, basically? So the more classical one is shareholder value maximization or shareholder governance. And that basically the idea is that corporations and their directors should maximize the value of the company for their shareholders and their shareholders only, subject, of course, to regulatory constraints. If the law says you cannot pollute, then they have to respect the law. But if they meet the standards imposed by the law, they can basically pollute as much as they want, as long as it's in the interest of shareholders. And the underlying idea is that corporate law fulfills its task of maximizing welfare for society best if it focuses on shareholders, because that's what it does well, and the protection of all the other stakeholders, the environment, consumers, employers, suppliers, that should be dealt with by other branches of law. That's environmental regulation, labor law, bankruptcy law, tax law, to redistribute everything. And there's a couple of people who advocate for that view. Milton Friedman is the most famous, most classical one there. The criticism there that you probably have heard of is that, well, that works only if we can believe that environmental regulation, tax law, etc., are going to be working as they should to protect stakeholders and to incorporate the externalities that the corporation generates. And it doesn't seem to be doing that. So perhaps we should also try to change corporate law, because all these other branches of law, they don't seem to be enough. A variation of this is enlightened shareholder value maximization, and I see this as a bit of the third way. And here the idea is that corporations and also their directors should maximize value for shareholders, but taking into account the long-term interests of the shareholders and the interests of environment and stakeholders and etc. So they're taking it into account, but only to the extent that it creates shareholder value. So here the idea is that often you have, by doing good for your stakeholders, by doing good for the environment, you will do good for shareholders as well in the long term, because consumers will reward you with their business, etc. So you have a bit of a win-win there. So there's no need to trade off. The criticism here, I think, is that, well, it's a bit naive to think that there's only going to be win-wins and that there's never going to be a situation where you can harm the stakeholders in a way that does well for shareholders. I think those situations arise. And that's there's a lot of prominent advocates of that as well, although you could also say sometimes these people are true stakeholder capitalists. But for me, this view is not super interesting because I don't see it as fundamentally different as the shareholder primacy view. In the end, it's the same, but just saying, but often there won't be a conflict. Well, if they're not a conflict, then there's no problem, of course, but we are interested in a situation where there is a conflict between stakeholders and shareholders. What should a corporation do in that case? And then people, they're the true stakeholder capitalists or the true stakeholder governance people, they say, well, even if it harms the shareholders, the company can and even should perhaps serve the interests of other stakeholders as well. And here the underlying idea is often we should give the board the discretion to optimally balance the interests of stakeholders with those of shareholders. And there's not a hierarchy between them. It's not that shareholders are above other stakeholders. So that is a bit the idea there. So you put the trust in the board. And there's also some prominent advocates there. Here the criticism is that if you have board discretion to serve the interests of all stakeholders, the risk is that they won't serve any stakeholders, but they will serve their own interests. So because you create the discretion for the board to serve the stakeholders, you also increase the risk that you decrease the level of accountability. You could say, well, let's try to make them accountable to all the stakeholders. The problem with that is that it's hard because often what's in the interest of one stakeholder is not in the interest of another, and it's hard to balance these interests and hard to make the board accountable for doing so. Perhaps some say it's even impossible. So that's a bit the debate. That's out there in corporate law, and what should we be doing about that? And the answers that countries have come up with, that's what this slide basically summarizes. There's some jurisdictions where we say, well, we stick with the shareholder value model, maybe the enlightened shareholder value model, but I've said it's not that different. And for example, you have the United States. Well, I should say Delaware, because all the states have different corporate laws, and Delaware has a shareholder value model. I can talk about the details of when and how it applies, but I think for this audience, it's perhaps not that interesting, but you can ask me follow-up questions if you want a clarification. So Delaware, it's duty towards shareholders. UK has adopted a very clear language in their statute saying that we need to promote the success of the company for the benefit of its members, so that the members are the shareholders as a whole, and have regard for, and then it's a whole list, the consequence in the long term, the interest of the employees, etc. But this is basically enlightened shareholder value. We have regard for those people, but in the end, what you should maximize is what you need to promote is the interest of the shareholders. That's a bit how it's conceived in the law there. Belgium, there's a Cour de Cassation, the Supreme Court, who said that the corporate interests, so the interest of the corporation, is about maximizing value for shareholders. The current shareholders and the future shareholders. And the future shareholders, that's all, again a bit the enlightened shareholder value idea that it's in the future shareholders, the long term, they will care about the environment, but only to the extent that it benefits the shareholders at some point in time. So that's a bit how our company law deals with it. There's one nuance in the new companies code in 2019 adopted. There's a possibility for corporations to incorporate additional non-profit goals in their articles of association, But that's not a mandatory thing, that's an optional thing. There's other countries who clearly take the stakeholder view, and they say, well, directors and corporations, they should not only maximize shareholder value. You have many other US states that permit the board explicitly to take into account the interests of other constituencies or other stakeholders. There's the Netherlands, who says that the corporation or the directors must balance the interests of all stakeholders. So it's not permissive, but must. And Germany, similar, also has a stakeholder view. France, after the recent Loi Pacte of 2019, also the corporation must be managed in its social interest. So also with the stakeholder view. And finally, there's the EU, which has a proposal, so not a directive yet, so it's not legally binding, maybe adopted, it probably will be adopted, I think. And their Article 25 of the sustainability due diligence, you may have heard about this, so the corporations now have to do due diligence in their supply chain if it's adopted. Well, it also incorporates a duty for the member states to put in their corporate law that the board of directors needs to act in the best interest of the company, take into account the consequences of their decisions for sustainability matters, including human rights, climate change, environmental consequences, including the short, medium, and long term. That's very vague, I would say. You could say, debate, is that even stakeholder duty? Do you have to maximize the interests of all stakeholders, or is that simply enlightened shareholder value? Because it says, take into account the consequences. So, If you take it into account and then decide not to pursue those, that's also taken into account. So it's probably deliberately vague. And probably this is a political compromise because it's the EU. Okay, so what can we expect actually from these directors' duties? So the duties to act in the interests of stakeholders, shareholders? Well, one thing you could say is that in any case it doesn't matter that much, because typically shareholders cannot really enforce directors' duties. Most countries have something like a business judgment rule. That's very specific in the US. It's clear that if you're not acting with a conflict of interest, or you're yourself the counterparty in a transaction, if that's not the case, and you are informed, so it basically means you have to put in the paper, well, we as a board, we deliberated for an hour about this and then we reached a decision. If that's the case, basically your decision is safe and the court will not review it. That's in the US. But most other countries have similar doctrines trying to insulate the board of directors. In Europe, there's even many more barriers to shareholder litigation, so it's very difficult to bring a shareholder suit against the board of directors. So in practice, it doesn't really mean that much in any case. So it's not that you really can enforce these duties anyway. And even if you have duties only towards shareholders, it's typically allowed to take into account all the interests of stakeholders. So you can do a lot of things good for stakeholders, even if the duty is purely shareholder oriented, by just saying, well, in some point in time, this will also benefit shareholders, and then you're basically safe. On the other side of this means that if you are having duties of directors towards stakeholders, it's very unlikely that you're ever going to have stakeholders who are able to enforce those duties anyway. For the same reasons, it's hard to bring litigation. There's a business judgment rule. But also because as soon as you have multiple stakeholders, as I've said, it's hard to be accountable to one of them, because you can always point to a different stakeholder that you are serving. Yeah? If you're saying, well, I'm cutting down this forest, I'm doing it to save the company and its employees, one stakeholder, and although it's bad for the environment, the forest, et cetera. So that's a bit the tricky part. You cannot really get accountability towards stakeholders through just these duties. Doesn't mean that they don't matter at all. I think if you have a takeover, that's probably when the duties become most concrete. For example, you have a case in Delaware, Revlon, most famous, and it says that if you're selling the company, you have to sell it for the highest price. Very briefly summarized, but that's what it comes down to. In the Netherlands, you had a case, and the board basically admitted, and the court said, we're not probably selling the company at this price would be the best thing for shareholders, but we won't do it because of this and this reasons that include stakeholders. If you would say that or do that in Delaware, probably wouldn't work. In the Netherlands, it works. So there's some difference there. With a takeover, it becomes very concrete because you offer the shareholders a concrete price, and there's no long term anymore because for the shareholders, if you're selling the company, that's they get their money for their shares, and then it's over. So the long term, the short term becomes the long term, and there it probably matters. But for many other contexts, it doesn't really matter in any case what director's duties you have. There's also some empirical evidence for this in the U.S. There's authors who looked at what did the board do if they could take into account in these states that have the constituent statutes. What did the board do when negotiating for a takeover? And then they found, well, not much except trying to get a good price for shareholders and get golden parachutes for themselves. That's a bit the cynical view of what stakeholder governance critics have predicted in any case. If you have just board discretion, you don't get stakeholder governance, you get managerial governance, managers acting in their own interests. And that's a bit the critique of stakeholder governance. Well, you could say, well, maybe the problem is that we're not having real stakeholder governance. We need to put the stakeholders into the boardroom. That's a bit the whole idea of director nominations. The most prominent or most concrete versions of that are about putting the employees on the boardroom. Because we have a few countries, we have Germany and France, which require to have employees, nominations, directors in the board. In Germany, it's half-half, basically, of the supervisory board that needs to be, half of them is employee, although the chairman will in practice often be shareholder nominated and he'll have a casting vote, but still it's quite a lot of influence. In France, it's one director, or if you have more than eight directors in total, then you need to have two. So it's a minority, but still probably has some influence. In the US, there were also some proposals to get there, but Elizabeth Warren didn't get elected as president, as could have been expected. And so this is probably going nowhere. Rationale there is, well, the employees, they have need to have a voice in the corporation's governance because they make a lot of investments into the corporation that are firm specific. You learn a lot about how to make water, for example, and how to best do it in the conditions for a spadel, but that's perhaps not very relevant expertise outside of this specific company. And if you don't protect employees against that, then the company will always be able to expropriate the employees. The criticism of this approach, especially to have employee-nominated directors, well, what about other stakeholders and employees who have perhaps diverging interests, who don't really care about employees because they care about the environment, for example? What will an employee director do when he has to balance profitability of the corporation and therefore perhaps jobs, job losses or job increases versus the environment? Probably they will serve their own interests or their own constituencies' interests, so the interests of employees, which also, second criticism, they may be oriented more on the short term because they're not that interested in investing for the long term, if that means that jobs are going to be created in different areas, different regions, that maybe lead to current employees being fired because their skills have become obsolete as the company is transforming technologically. So that's a bit of a problem with the employee directors, that they're perhaps introducing their own interests into the boardroom, even though they actually don't have a stake in the long-term value creation for society per se, or at least they're also not perfectly aligned. At least shareholders are putting their money there in the sense that the shareholders only get paid out if all of the other people, the creditors, the employees, are paid out, and if their company is complying with the laws. An alternative you could say, and this is happening to some extent, is we need to have directors nominated by NGOs or the government. And then you can debate who is the best at serving the public interest. You can think about state-owned enterprises. David talked a lot about Vivacqua. I had a Watergroup case study, which is basically the Flemish equivalent of Vivaqua, but I think I can go quicker through that because you explained it so well already for how it works in Brussels. The NGOs, I don't think that's like a big thing right now to have NGO nominated directors on companies' board, but I recently, actually this morning, read, and I put this new on the slide, there's a certification, the ZOOP certification, it's a Dutch thing. I think it's like zoology and cooperative put together, ZOOP, apparently. And you get the certificate that you are a certified ZOOP corporation if you have a board observer, so not a board member, from the Zoonomic Institute. And the Zoonomic Institute will then represent the interests of the non-human life in the boardroom.
Did you mention that to Hendrik?
Yeah, that's the pigs trial.
Is that the pigs trial?
He just showed a slide that the pigs were accountable for eating the harvest or killing the boy.
So that's actually that's very relevant there. So it exists. It's not being hugely successful. There's no big corporation that has a soap director. It's also a board observer, so they don't have voting rights, etc. But it's a step in that direction, and it's not a crazy idea to say that I could see that happening at some point. Okay, so that's a bit the whole corporate law, corporate governance discussion. And now I want to move a bit of why water is special. I think it can move quite quickly because I think it's very clear for most of you that water is essential for human survival, and that it's why it's special. And there's a lot of worrying facts that access to clean water is in danger. Like 20% of people lack safely managed drinking water, and natural wetlands are shrinking. There's water stress also in Belgium, is rated as high baseline water stress, which is the second highest level, so it's not doing great. There's a global water crisis, and climate change will only exacerbate this water crisis for several reasons that I found in this report. More interesting for me as a law and economist guy is there's a case for government intervention, you could say. There's a market failure here. Water is a commons. And then I use it a bit in the law and economics terminology, the strategy of the commons. It means that, there's a risk that people overconsume it because at least if you don't put property rights on who can exactly consume it, and David explained quite well how difficult it is to put property rights and also what the risks are of that. But if you leave it unregulated, then it will probably be overconsumed. And everyone needs access to clean water, even if the market cannot produce it at a profit. So it's something that we think everyone should have as a right. Something that perhaps should be added to that is water is also, or tap drinking water is probably a natural monopoly, because as soon as you have the infrastructure, it doesn't make sense to duplicate it and have a second player in the same market provide water. Because it's just so costly to have the infrastructure, and you'll probably be outcompeted. And so it's a natural monopoly, so the market is not really working so well. We have a market failure, we say. And market failures are reasons for the government to intervene. And even in a capitalist world for you, you would say that that's where the government should be doing its job. And that's also what is happening. In Flanders, you have a duty for the government to provide basic drinking water services, which is fulfilled in practice by intercommunales, such as Pietpa, who was already mentioned, I think they're in Antwerp. You have different ones. You also have the Watergroep, which is in Flanders, the biggest one. And it's not an intercommunales, but that's an autonomous government enterprise. And so basically these government or government-like institutions, they are providing basic drinking water services. And here I had the case study of the Watergroep and its governance. So it's an autonomous Flemish government enterprise. So it's public in a way, but it's also private. It's like this hybrid in corporate law. It's a cooperative company of public law, and that means it's owned by, it's established by the decree, and it's owned by the government. So basically, by the regions, the provinces. And the region, only the Flemish region, and provinces and the commune, the cities. And basically its task is to provide drinking water in Belgium, well, I should say, well, Flanders more specifically, to 177 communes. And they also do some waste management, but that's not really the focus of today. So they are providing the basic tap water, and their goal is to make it also affordable, economically and ecologically sustainable. That's their mission that they put on their website. And their governance model reflects that to some extent, because their directors are basically nominated by all kind of public institutions. So by the General Assembly. The General Assembly is only, the shareholders are public institutions. There's some nominated by the Flemish government. There's some independent directors, but they're also nominated by the Flemish government upon proposal of the board of directors, and the board of directors is basically government representative. So basically it's all people who are expected to have the public interest in mind. And so that's one governance model where you have stakeholder capitalism, stakeholder governance through public ownership and public appointed, government appointed directors. So that's one model of having water governance just done by the public, because you have this market failure, and I think that's probably justified. So here you have a clear case of what you would say is stakeholder capitalism, stakeholder governance, that I would support. But the more interesting question perhaps is there also a case for private ownership, and what should the governance then be of a private corporation? Should it be shareholder governance, or is there also stakeholder governance there? And there, I think you can make some arguments that state-owned enterprises, they have some disadvantages. And I think this is well known in the economic literature that, in general, they're less efficient for a couple of reasons, because they have non-economic goals. It's harder to monitor how well the management are doing, because they don't have competition. There's less incentives to be productive. They often have natural monopolies. The taxpayer may be liable if it goes wrong. They may have to bail out these public institutions. And directors are appointed politically, so it's not often not on merit. And these factors lead, or probably are plausible explanations for why empirically researchers find that state-owned enterprises often underperform compared to private enterprises. You can discuss about that, whether that's true, or maybe we can try to make it better, and there's several ways to solve that. But in general, in a capitalist society, which I think we live in, we do think that if there's no market failure, we can have private ownership and it works more efficiently. I think you can make a case that selling bottled water is more of a luxury product, and that can be fulfilled by the market, by privately owned corporations, provided, and there's certain conditions I think that are important. First, we can safely regulate the water, the safety level of water. And I think it should be doable, and I think the government believes it's doable, so that you're trusting as a consumer that if you buy water, bottled water, that it's safe to drink. It's quite heavily regulated. And the second one is that you have also safe drinking water from the taps that is provided at affordable prices. Because there you have that's probably the most efficient way to provide it, the most sustainable one. It's a natural monopoly, so that's a task for the government. But if people do still want to buy bottled water on top of that, that's a free country, as you could say, if you're living in America, it's a free country, then you should be able to do that. One important side note here, of course, this assumes the second condition, that we have sufficient water for everyone to drink. And I think at the moment this is not a problem, in the sense that there's no very urgent water crisis, in the sense that there's still water coming from the taps everywhere. But in the future this may be a problem, and then I think it may be justified that the government says, well, all these private water sources, as in SPA, we don't want that to be in private hands. We want to integrate that into the public drinking water system. And I think that's fair. If water becomes so scarce that the second condition would not be fulfilled anymore, then the government should step in. But we it should take into account there's a right to property in the European Convention of Human Rights, and if you expropriate private water sources and the contracts that you have, you break them, then of course you have to compensate for that. So that's something to keep into mind. But so I conclude they're bottled water companies. There's no problem for me, at least, to have that in a capitalist society done by private ownership. The question then is, do we want it? Do we mandate stakeholder governance there, or do you also allow shareholder governance? And then we come back to the whole debate. Should it be shareholder value maximization, enlightened shareholder value maximization, or stakeholder governance? What I found interesting to see is that what I would say is the fourth way that we observe that in practice. And of course, you would think the third way, that's a bit what social democracy was all about, that would have been more sense. But I think the third way was already enlightened shareholder value maximization, that people called it's a third way. It's the compromise between stakeholder and shareholder. We don't have to have this dichotomy. Well, I think that people nowadays agree that enlightened shareholder value maximization is not really a new way. This one is a bit different, I think. And I think it consists of examples of companies making voluntary commitments to take into account the interests of stakeholders in a way that's legally binding. And there are several ways that you can do that. For example, you can have stakeholder-oriented or public-oriented corporate forums. I realize it's perhaps a bit small. So what you can do here, and the rationale here is that you want to have in your laws a signaling and commitment device that if corporations want to signal that they care about stakeholders, then they can do that, and they can actually make binding commitments that they will serve the interests of stakeholders. And why would they do that? Well, they may believe that it helps for them to attract ESG-minded, sustainability-minded investors, consumers, and employees who are more likely to invest with or stay with the company if they are making these commitments. And this may be especially true for consumer-focused companies such as bottled water salespeople, where there's especially also very big sustainability impact because you have a lot of sustainability questions related to water. What could you do then? In the US, you can adopt a benefit corporation. Basically, this is you take a normal for-profit corporation in Delaware, and you put a public benefit in its articles of association. And that's allowed. The law has a separate chapter on that. And basically, you put something that you want to have a positive effect on one or more categories of persons, etc. And the board and the shareholders need to approve that. And then the director's duty shifts from just serving the interests of shareholders to you have to balance the interests of shareholders with stakeholders and with the public benefit. Again, the question is to what extent is the director's duties, is that relevant, especially here, because in the US, in Delaware, it says this is not enforceable by these any individual stakeholders. So the only thing it means is that it's even less enforceable by shareholders if the board violates this duty. It just means we're giving less power to shareholders, but no single stakeholder will be able to sue because you're not pursuing your public benefit. So you have this more freedom for the board, and you have public benefit statements, so basically disclosures that you have to do every 2 years on how are you serving your public benefit. So that's the benefit corporation. In France, you have the Société à Mission, which is also, again, a normal for-profit corporation, but you have to put into the company statutes a raison d'être, like a purpose, basically, why you're doing something good, and also social and environmental objectives aligned with this purpose. And then you have to establish a monitoring committee, and you have to be audited by an independent third party whether or not you're actually doing that. So then you're a Société à Mission. Your director's duty don't change because all companies already have to be managed in the social interest. In Belgium, we have a complicated system, which I don't think is that great. You have to, you can establish a cooperative company, and then you have to basically adhere to the principles of cooperative companies. So you have to satisfy the needs of your own investors. So you have to be producing goods, for example, that you're delivering to your shareholders. Think of ACCO, the book corporation, cooperative. So you get lower prices if you buy books as a shareholder, or a cooperative of different farmers working together to distribute their goods. And those can also get a certificate of having a social purpose, a certification as a social enterprise. So it means basically that you also have to follow on some certain conditions that you are acting in the social interest. For example, you have to put that in your articles of association again, and there's also a profit lock and an asset lock, which means you cannot distribute all of your assets and profits back to shareholders. So you put limits on that, and in return you get a label when you're acting in the market, and the idea is that this will attract these ESG-minded investors. And then internationally, you also have a very popular one, the B Corp certification. So it is not linked to a specific jurisdiction. All countries can have that. But basically, it means you get a certification from the B Lab, which is an NGO or a non-profit corporation. And you incorporate in your articles of association that you will have a positive impact. And depending on your jurisdiction, this means that you may have to adopt public benefit corporation form in Delaware, for example, or in France, you have to adopt the raison d'être that I talked about. In Belgium, you have to adopt this clause in the articles of association that I list there. And you have to do a B impact assessment, a certain scoring system of how your impact on environment and social performance, etc., is. And you have to disclose some of that, and you have to recertify every 3 years. So it's building further upon these different legal corporate forms that we have with another certification.